whose solos and duets with himself are greeted by spasms of laughter from his uninhibited companions, who, heard singly, are the whippoorwill, the cowbird, white-breasted nuthatch, purple martin, blue jay, Chuck Will's widow, and the barred owl. That's the gang that participates in this Fish Crow jam session. The final section, Misterioso, contains only thrushes. The olive-backed thrush, wood thrush, gray-cheeked thrush, and hermit thrush. Now, because of time limitations, we'll begin in the middle of the first movement of this recording, the Symphony of the Birds, and we'll play as much as we have time for. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have to play of this recording, this point in the third movement of...
disciplined manner, do the work that I'm supposed to do, and get it to you on a regular sort of a basis, and you would look it over and send it back. But the first thing I think is to get another copy made of the darn thing.
Yeah, I'm so afraid it'll be destroyed. You know, terribly anxious about that.
Sure. Well, before I leave, I'll take care of that little detail. That's not so much there, and we can get a copy of it. I'd have one. I got, of course, the one I have is partially typed, partly handwritten. You know, and I don't think I could even decipher it myself, but if I had the copy that you've got now and you had a stenographer's copy, mm-hmm. and that in a disciplined manner, week by week, I just go over this darn mm-hmm. thing, that we could agree, perhaps, if we have time before you leave, agree on some sort of a general structure. And, got it down on paper, says, well, Connor Post or Wright, I think Wright was one I had to show, well, Negroes can't do anything because of the conditions that exist don't allow them to become psychologically and emotionally prepared to live in this country and so forth and so on, to take a place as an equal citizen in the country. And I think that the truth of the matter is that under the strain and under the heat, you know, and pressure of this country, a Negro can't help but do one or two things. Either become a good person and a fighter for freedom, or else, you know, completely degenerate into nothing at all. The world we live in is either going to shatter him completely, or else he's going to come out of this crucible as a man.
Which,
you know,
is true of the white person too.
Yeah, but Wright wouldn't say that.
No.
No. Oh, that goes for any man. But not, I didn't mean that this is just Negro. But I think that the Negro has a tremendous thing to overcome. Simply on the heritage that these guys like Wright have left for us. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, of stopping saying, well, I can't do this, and I'm not able to do it. Tremendous struggle with me. It's a tremendous struggle. There's a kid here I gotta go see. He was a literary editor of the Quest there at Central High School when I was editor. He was a tremendously talented kid. For three straight years, he won the first prize in all divisions of art. I mean, in woodcut, you know, in his field, rather, in woodcuts, and linoleum cuts, and ink sketches, and in pencil sketches.
Who's
he won
that?
A fellow named Chuck Curry. Today he served a total of 11 years in prison, four of them in San Quentin. He's lost an eye in some brawl down on the waterfront there. He's almost insane, you know. And just wasted, you know, because Chuck didn't believe that facing this whole doggone social system we live in and fighting against it, you know, that as even though he didn't realize it, and certainly I didn't realize it either, I don't think any human being does, but in the struggle itself, these subtle changes in one's character and in one's belief and in one's fate in the triumph of democracy and the strength of the common people is something that's going to you'll overcome then, but you can't overcome as long as you believe, like Wright wants to teach us, that well, because we're Negro, we can never be prepared to live in the white man's world, like he says in this Man Underground, that we just can't do it. We're brutalized and we're destroyed by this struggle, but I think that it's only through the struggle that you become whole and sympathetic and humanized, you know. I mean, that goes for anybody, not just Negroes, but especially I think it must apply to Negroes, but he's got a double struggle on his hands. And this is the thing I think has got to be the whole central theme of it. If I could show in my own life how I went from a kid who was really defeated into the Communist Party and got to know the meaning of struggle and the role that struggle has to play in a person's life, I think something is accomplished.
How do you think you got this deep feeling that you have about the people? I mean, this came from your experience, and I think that's something that must come out in the book, which Wright felt up to a certain point and then repudiated.
Yeah.
He did feel that. You know when he said when he left the party that he would never again feel...
Yes, you know, I remember that letter, yeah.
Oh, my.
How could he write that letter and still leave?
I know. Wasn't that terrible?
God. Well,
But how
I don't
did you
know.
Get that... I'm very interested in how people, you know, the difference of people who get that deep feeling
and
those who don't, you know.
I don't know when it started, man. I guess it started way back in Warsaw because the whole town was so damn poverty-ridden, you know. But I think it probably started there, but I never understood it.
How did you guys go to Warsaw? Did your father get a job there?
Well, he was, he reached a certain point in his job where either had to be elevated into another position or else lose his seniority by being transferred. And so they transferred us down into this stick here, you know, thinking that...
This was in the post office.
Yeah, well, he was a railway mail clerk at that time. So.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was another division point. That could take him, you know, out of St. Paul. So that's where we had to go. I mean, unless he had to resign resign from his job. But I don't think the Warsaw experience was too important except to show me that there's a whole lot of people on Earth that are a lot poorer than I was. But I think where I began to understand the struggle of the people, and I think in an immature, high schoolish kind of a way, I was trying to say that in one little article I published with high school magazine, The Quest, that I happened to run across a couple of weeks ago, and I realized then that's what I was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was on the road, when I was hoboing around, and I saw it then, the strength, the tremendous strength of these bums, you know, that dirty and unshaven, and they're, I mean, little things like how a guy would, when he made his coffee and he finished with his coffee, he put the coffee grounds into a can, hung it on a tree where maybe the next guy, you know, didn't have anything at all, he could reboil the grounds, you know, and he'd get something, a little nourishment out of it, you know. That, and out in Seattle and Spokane, where I hoboed around, worked around a little time, and I saw this strength of these guys that underneath everything that society had done them, had crushed them and put them on the road, they didn't even have a home. Most of them didn't even have bedrolls that looked like the worst that they were treated. Those that got strong got so much stronger for being treated that way.
Mm.
I can remember some of their names even yet. Some of them I can even see them. Some of these old timers who had been on the road since the recession right after the World War, that were strong people, that had morals, you know, that had ethics. I think that I tried to point some of this out in the part that I wrote there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where it started. And then, of course, when I was in the Army, then it was even stronger there, because I saw a lot of guys who were weakened and just morally in intellectually died during that war, and I saw for every one of them that died, there was 50 of them, you know, that became men. And when we got to Philippine Islands, well, we met the revolutionaries, you know, and the Hucks, and met women who were, well, I met a lot of school teachers who go to bed with you for a book. They didn't want any money, they wanted a book. You know,
a book.
To teach with, you know. I know I got in such a bad bit of trouble there. I was afraid I was going to get dishonorable discharge. I was operations sergeant of my battalion, and by being such, I had the charge of all the training manuals, and of course the Army published a book on everything from astronomy to Shakespeare, including the algebra and all phases of English and all sorts of stuff. And I gave away the entire battalion's books. Mm-hmm. I couldn't stand to see these people hunger, you know, for learning and not be able to get it. And here I had all these books that the Army's going to burn up anyway, so I gave them all away. And when it came time to dissolve the battalion, we couldn't account for the books, you know. So they knew, of course, that I gave them away. And then part of this, too, was the infantry commander of our division was the president of Columbia University. What the hell was his name? I can't think of his name right now.
President?
But, yeah. And I remember when we rested on a little island called Emeru, we were on, we had our rest period there. We built a university, the largest university in the world. It was won by 5 miles. Just one building after another. And everybody,
really?
Yeah, everybody in the division had to go to school. You either went to school or you unloaded boats. And
where was that?
A little island called Emeru. It's right north of Rabaul.
The greatest university.
The biggest university in the world.
It was?
It actually was. We built it out of just bamboo poles and thatched roofs. And we had, everybody who had a high school education had to teach. And everybody who didn't have a high school education had to go to school or else unload boats. And unloading boats is a horrible job. And so everybody went to school. You didn't have to drill or anything. You just go to school. And so I remember when I was there, I taught English and algebra and Shakespeare. And I took a course in Shakespeare.
You taught Shakespeare?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well,
Younger Martin.
Younger.
It's been working.
Everybody looks younger.
I tell you.
All look younger.
Jesus, I bet. Sit down, Martin.
Well, when did you get in?
I got in last night. About, about 9 o'clock. Sit down, Martin.
Uh-huh. So.
How's Tiny?
Well, she's fine.
Good. Karen's doing all right?
Oh, yeah.
Karen's a beautiful woman already.
I imagine she's a woman in the bath. Jesus,
look
well, though.
You look good, too.
I'm living. Christ, help it. Mm-hmm. Struggling along, you know. The fight's good for a guy, you know. He keeps his eye on the... Struggle. We just, Mary Ellen and I just spent the whole afternoon talking about that.
Uh-huh.
You keep your eye on the people. Well, you're not going to throw all that over.
No.
It takes a whole lot to eat a fighter, you know.
Yeah.
So, how was it, Mike?
Well, not bad. Kicking along.
And I guess it's the same all over.
Oh yeah,
they're all
the same all over.
Doing what you can, and
yeah,
it's never enough.
Yeah.
But it's sure good to see. I was planning to drop over that way tomorrow. I got to see Sam and Carl.
Uh-huh.
You are one.
Oh, why don't you come over?
Well,
come over, Sam, and I may drop over too.
Fine.
A few minutes.
I mean, fine. You're not working on the building trades, are you, Mark?
No.
Oh.
I'm looking around for a job and I haven't gotten one. The more I look, the less chance.
I know what you mean.
Well, now I tried the scrap iron. Yeah. No.
There.
I think it's going to be tough this winter.
Mm.
Yeah, it is. I went down I came in here on a wheel and a prayer, you know, and I'm going to have to get a couple of days work myself before I go back, but I went down to Union Hall and business days in there, you're so happy to see me. Said, well, we work something out, you know, give me a couple of days work before I go back. I guess I'm going to have to make a bricklayer out of you, Martin, so you'd be able to get a couple months in a year anyway.
I don't have a skill.
It's almost impossible. Any of the trades,
pretty hard to get into.
They got them pretty well tightened up.
So tight, you can... I tried one, there's a guy, you know, wanted a helper, you know. Well, he didn't know, you know. Changed his mind, then let me... So, not if I get on the help.
What else can I do? I don't know how to do anything.
Good frame, big leg,
Christ. It's
It's pretty good, you know. It's pretty good. Being a carpenter or something like that is better because you work more steadily, but, I mean, for an intensive person, I don't want to work steady anyway, so I keep my nose above water. Well, what the hell? I have some time for other things, you know.
Yeah, and get carpenter's work. Maybe I'll go down the range and carpenter. Apply for union carbs, say I'm working, you know, doing carpenter work for the farmers.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe get me in a union.
Oh, sure. Yeah, anybody who, you know, just get that person to vouch for you and say you're a carpenter, that's all it takes. Don't have to. I was talking to Carol and he was telling me about, first when Ross came to him and he was telling me about Bob Kelly carrying those 12-inch blocks and I thought, poor guy, I know he's dying, you know. Oh, those I haven't worked in so many years.
Roughing them up.
Why, yeah. But I guess, I guess I'm just going to have to come back to Minneapolis and build a party up where we get enough dues to put a guy like you back on the desk. And get the CIO and AFL together. We're going to look like teamsters and building trades and bakers and watchmakers are going to split off and form their own union anyway, the way everything's shaping up.
Yeah, there's good things and bad things in labor movement. Yeah, it's same here.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the general thing is good. I know we had, just at our last union meeting, we had a terrible time. One of the international reps was down there. He was sit up on the floor and told us, you either merge by the 6th, or we're going to merge you. That is to say, we lift your charter, you know, and organize a new union. Got it. One time, everybody's on their feet. God damn you, you son of a bitch, you'll be a match hammer war around here too. We try to lift our charter.
This is what we
want to
know. What do you want to say?
I want to say that there isn't such a thing as a condition or a psychology or a history or any other thing that can brutalize people. There just isn't. I mean that I don't even know how to put in words myself. That
it cannot brutalize people.
It just can't. That it makes people strong, and that's the whole secret of life. Is the struggle against brutality, and the struggle against not having, the struggle against discrimination, the struggle to be a human being, to be a man, to be dignified is the thing that makes people. Contrary to what Wright's talking about, it's the fight itself that makes you love your fellow man, and it's his attempt to brutalize you, which takes the brutality out of you, that makes you see that life is a precious thing, and that it has to be loved and developed and nurtured and taken care of.
Well, this is what you want to say.
This has got to be said. That hasn't really been said from the literature of Negroes, and it's something that's got to be said. I don't think anybody's really said it.
That's right. And the Negroes are leading this,
right.
The whole feeling of the struggle of the people.
This is for your trip.
Let's get down to why. I mean, I think your book is different than Wright's, of how a person gets to feel this alliance with the people. Now, why didn't Wright feel it? He came up in that. I mean, why do you feel it and Wright did not, you know? What's that?
I don't know. Maybe the war is the difference, you know? And then, too, I came up 10 years later than Wright did. I mean, I began thinking, you know, 10 years later than he did. I think it had a lot to do with it.
The main thing with me is, Wright, is why was he so tempted by what you can get? You know, he was so tempted by wealth. You know, now we were discussing that this afternoon, you know. What can you get by wealth, and what does it get you? You know yourself that Wright, from the outsider, and his whole... I mean, he's just at the end of his rope as a human being.
It is brutalized. Well, Mary, that's what we were saying in the car. I think the turning point in a person's life is when he realizes the unconquerable strength of the people and aligns himself with it. I don't think Wright ever did that. He didn't do it in Black Boy.
No.
I mean, in Native Son, he didn't do it.
No. He did in his early 50s.
In Brighton Morning Star, he did.
Brighton Morning Star.
I just got through reading it, you know, and all I thought it
Isn't
was...
Isn't that beautiful?
It's a, you know, I mean, for that period, you know, I mean, even though it was
a brutal
thing in itself. I mean, you know what I mean.
Right now, that's a great
It
period.
Is. I just got through rereading it. It's about 2 months ago.
I did, too. I read it.
And there he had it, but I wonder actually if he really did, you know? You can't, I mean, Mary, that was, it's not something that you can feel and understand, and then 10 years or 50 years later not understand. You just can't.
Yeah, how do you change?
You can't change it if you don't understand it. You can't change it. Mary Ellen, if I didn't know this from the very bottom of not just heart, but from the bottom of my life, if I didn't understand that, well, my God Almighty, I think the things that I went through with the party, I'd have just quit. But I never, I see this honestly, that I never went through a moment after this expulsion when I was almost nuts, you know, primarily from inactivity of not being able to aid in this struggle. But not once did I think for a minute that someday out of the guts of the workers and farmers in this country, there's going to come a movement that, by God, is going to establish socialism in this country. And whether it's a party or not, I don't care anymore. But the point of it is that I've always known, and I know now, that there's going to be this movement coming up. It might not be the party, mm-hmm. but it's going to come. It's going to come, and it's going to come right out of their guts, you know, and it's going to be a raucous, hell-raising party if necessary, or movement. But whatever it's going to be a people's movement. And I'll be part of it. You know, I know that all the time, that this what happens in the CP is a passing affair, and it's part of the struggle. And these guys will die away and be lost. But still, out of the foundation that I helped lay, it's going to come a movement that's going to establish socialism. And I know that because I know that this mass is unconquerable.
Well, this is the core of the thing. This is it. I mean, in which the whole book develops around. If you want to get that core, you know, you can structure the whole book around it. Everything, you know, goes into it. And this to me is the important. If you want to get that, then we can just, you know, work it, heat it, you know, it's in the
The thing that stymies me all the time is to show it and not see it, you know what I mean?
Not see it. See, but you've got to have it. This is the central thing. How did you develop this? Now you see, I can see right now all whole episodes in your book which would gain direction, you know.
I can't.
Which now don't have any direction. They're just episodes. You can just see how they would drive the hammer in, you know.
While you were saying that, I realized something about, I guess, my life and everybody's life, that it's only through the defeats, you know, when they whip you.
Yeah.
You know, and you're being able to get back on your feet and try to fight back, that you understand anything.
All right. I mean, that's something also. You
and I haven't had a successful thing in my whole life.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I feel as I do.
Sure. Anybody who has a successful life, it's only because they had a small goal.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing.
I think you hit the kid right square.
If we get this central idea, you know.
For a few characters in there, I've always felt that. I don't know. I know it's wrong now, but I've always felt that stories that are so open in their structure was not a good thing.
Well, do you feel that Bright Morning Star, that it's too
obvious? I thought so.
Well, I always say.
Came looking for a crane or something, some bird that she knew where it was, but he was so beautiful that
And when she offered him $5 or $10, I guess, to lead her to the bird, and her aunt wanted her to do it, but she finally decided that she wasn't going to, you know, and went away and hid that night until he was gone. Well, the structure...
Why was this?
I can't remember the name. It's a very famous New England writer, one of the first, really...
Sarah Orne Jewett?
I wouldn't doubt it. Geez, I don't even remember. But at any rate, there you can see that structure so clearly, but it wasn't offensive in my opinion. You know,
structure can never be offensive. I make people make a statement of the narrative question, it makes it seem mechanical. But I make them make that because 10 to 1, the sins of a writer are vagueness. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know what the narrative question is.
Yeah.
I don't think that in a story... Mm-hmm.
With the class, I missed the class, you know.
Oh, I don't remember you coming at all.
Oh yeah, I was there some of the time.
Did you certainly didn't get much of an idea?
No, I don't think I was there enough.
Well, get over this idea of it being a mechanical thing, but that it's not.
Go to hell, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard to say to them.
And yet I think our people instinctively know everything. The major problem is to come to consciousness in American life, I think. And because, you know, our people, you just tap them, you know, they're like great maples standing in the spring, you know, at tap time, you know. They're rich and wonderful. But they're so unconscious. I mean, it seems to me my struggle as a person has been against unconsciousness. You know, they're like...
Something, I mean, you had to do something terrible before you're recognized as a human being. Then everybody feels sorry for you. And outside of that, couldn't do a thing.
Earned a living while he...
But, he was a postman here, you know. I guess one of the first Negro postmen in the city. And, oh, he's 38 years on the job now, and he won't be sorry. He looks the same. He's just grayer, but he looks
38 years.
38 years on the job. I went down, I was down the union office there where Magny has put his fifth, this yesterday made his 50th year in the union. And so I was the first one to congratulate him, but he's gonna give me a job now. but at any rate, this guy, Curry, Buck Curry, the old man, he got, you know, he's got 2 boys and 6 girls, see? And I guess at this time while he had about 5 children. And you know, he's this doggone mailman. He's walking from door to door delivering mail. And so he gets in his affair with this blonde, you know? And he's a big husky guy, you know, the big booming voice and a mustache like Groucho Marx that spreads all the way across his face. He's a wonderful guy. And he's just full of hell, but it's underneath all of it. He's just a wonderful guy. Bucky didn't know what to do, you know. He didn't know whether he should, he didn't want to break off, you know, he didn't want to break off his affair with this girl, but he knew good and well that Hazel, his wife, she'd kill him, you know. The most she's ever weighed is 90 pounds. And she had triplets once, you know, triplets. So he went and so he just disappeared for a week with this woman.
Oh.
And so she was just furious. Well, of course, he came back. And when he came back, her clothes was packed, and the kid's supper was on the table, and she walked out the door as he walked in. And boy, he got the police to find her. Please come back and help me, these goddamn kids. And she stayed gone the same length of time that he stayed gone, you know? And she come back and says, damn you, how do you like it now? You know?
How many kids did
they have? Five little babies. And him tried, he didn't dare lose a day's work, you know, during the Depression and everything. And so he just about went nuts through that period. And we were over, we'd go over there, we'd be running all over the house, and the kids would be fighting, and Buck would be hollering at him to be quiet, you know. And he said, damn it, why wish your brother would come back? So it doesn't pay to... When you feel with this 18-year-old or 17 or 15, whatever you might be, you go to the next one, you know. But you keep saying, well, yourself that you're going to recapture something. You can't. And you know, it's more than just saying it's an adolescent thing. It's a tragedy that the American man has never done anything but work.
But work.
That's all. Just work.
Mm-hmm.
And come home so damn tired that he eats and... today looks at TV until he falls asleep, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's
I know. These jobs
it's
are...
terrible. It's a terrible thing.
Sam was saying the other day, talking about, you know, the everybody says the worker is making so much and has so much and everything. Sam was saying Minneapolis is suffering from fatigue. There's a fatigue of you can just see the whole city. Well, and most people have two jobs at a time.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I know. Bricklayers, you know, of course, we always work bent over. And it's true. You see these old-time bricklayers, they're going down the street humped over. You wonder, what the hell is he, hunchback, you know? And they know he's going hunchback. He's a bricklayer.
But it's, are there many of them that way?
Oh, all the old ones are.
As bad as Michelangelo, you know. He got bent the other way.
Yeah, from painting the dome. But it's a tragedy, though. That you look back, and I was reading this poem not so long ago. This fellow talking about how he pulled his life over him, you know, as a cover, you know, and he was looked back at this wasted youth that he had. I mean, it's just not him, it's all of us. I mean, even those of us who were conscious during our youth that we had a role to play in society, we wasted our youth. I mean, you know, I'm not wasting in total, but wasting the sense that we didn't do the best of the, you know, of our capabilities live. And we were too busy doing something else. I don't know what the hell we were doing. I don't know what I was doing.
Well, you can't.
I was in a war. I know what I was doing.
But in the Depression, too.
In the Depression, in a war.
It's just like saying you don't know if the ship is going down and you were swimming. What were you doing? You were trying to swim to shore.
Yeah. And you look at that doggone war, and it's a great big vulgar void, you know, in your life. From 18 to 23.
Yeah.
And when the time when I should have... And you ask me why I have so many wives. That's why. Because I never was 19 or 20. I never was 21. I never was 22.
Uh-huh.
You know, I never...
You had to get that all in.
I never got it in. You can't get it. Now you gotta get it in.
No.
And
you were 5 years.
Almost five. 4 years and 8 months. And the majority of them in those goddamn islands where you didn't see anybody, you didn't do anything, you slept beside the same guy and you ate with him and you marched with him and you cut holes in the jungle with him, and when he croaked, well, somebody else took his place and got to know him all over again. You know, just put him to the same guy. And he never had anything that was gentle or soft around him, or anything that was considerate. It's a terrible thing, that war. And this country, the people, is kind of going to pay for it for the rest of our generation. Going to pay for it. Twisted
thinking, you know, of all of us. You can't, and I've only come to realize this in the last 2 years, that you can't have a background of destruction, you know, especially of human life. That life, you know, I don't know whether I'm just getting older or whether I'm getting wiser, but life is such a precious thing, you know. It's the base of everything. And when you've had a background of the destruction of life and not being sensitive to life, well, it twists the rest of you. I know, when Florence and I were talking about something, I look out there, or was it back here, somewhere you've gone in, and they read, I thought, well, one of the things that you and Deb showed me, that my old man drove into me, that I think took hold of me because of the war, and that he used to always tell me, a man don't cry. And from that on went on to where a man doesn't have any emotion. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can't live like that.
That's a terrible.
You can't live like that. And I don't guess I got it out of me yet. I don't think I ever will get it out of me yet. But of course I realize it now, but I don't think I'll ever get it out. I guess that really must be.
Well,
good.
Naturally, I guess. Honestly, those things must. I often wonder how anyone can live after.
Life depends on discipline, you know? And the confidence that the guy next to you is disciplined, that he's going to do what he has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And his life depends on you doing what you have to do. And only through this, whether it's right or wrong or. Whether it's of any moral consideration doesn't mean a damn thing that you, and when you get out in the army, well, you say, well, I've got to do this, and you go and do it, and whoever gets hurt or knocked down and trampled on, it just doesn't make any difference, because in the long run, this is what has to be done, you know, and damn who hurts in the process. I know that's the way I felt, and I don't know. That's what's behind the what some people call the Peary culture. Very clannishness, you know, is that all of us got that from the old man. The old man, he's still shell-shocked. He's never been mustered out of service. He's always had this military sort of idea that you do what you have to do. Well, Jesus, there ain't nothing you have to do when you get older and you look at it, except live with humanity. And you don't blunder through that, you know, you gotta be cautious so you don't hurt anybody. But I've never been cautious until the last maybe 2 years, you know, in considering other people. You say, well, you get over to this point and then you can pick up the pieces, you know, when you're in a more secure position, but you never reach it. By the time you get it, there's another place you gotta go. That's been all my life. I remember, you know, during the war, I used to watch these guys, and I never been, you know, I never was religious, but I used to watch them, how they would slowly get down where they didn't have any consideration for life. Remember one fellow out of the South that he was a Jacobite preacher, and he went just slowly insane, you know, until he was just, was killed crazy, you know. Now, never forget the last engagement we had with the Japanese. There were these two damn fool soldiers that instead of standing up and putting their hands up, you know, and letting us take them in and feed them, you know, and put them in prison, that would be the end of it. Well, they had a couple old rusty rifles, and they started shooting at us, 11 of us and two of them. And naturally, as soon as we received fire, well, everybody just slammed down on them, you know. Both of them were wounded, but neither of them were killed. But we were about, maybe 20 miles away from our perimeter, a good 2 days march. And we couldn't carry wounded. I mean, just the Japanese wouldn't carry any wounded, neither would we. You just couldn't do it. You know, you had to look out for yourself. And so the procedure was always to shoot them, you know, and as painlessly as possible. And I can remember so clearly that I looked at these two guys, especially this one guy. He was a young officer. He was trying to, you know, beg for mercy, you know, and I just said to myself, God damn, I've got enough of it. I just couldn't even look at it anymore. I remember we were in a little stream, We didn't have any, the jungle was so thick that we were marching in the water. And these guys were alongside of the stream, and one of them was pretty badly shot in the stomach, and he was almost unconscious. But this officer was all wounded around the arms and legs, and he was just begging for mercy. But I just couldn't even look at him anymore.
And he wanted you to carry him back?
Yeah, well, anything. He just, you know, just have some mercy, you know, how hurt this animal is, you know, the same thing. And we had a young lieutenant by the name of Hartsfield with us. I guess he still lives out in Los Angeles. And so he turned to me and said, I was the sergeant of the patrol. He said, "Sergeant, have these men shot." And I said, "God damn, I'm not going to do it. You have them shot."